We are in Genesis chapter 38, going to start at verse 27 and finish up the story of what happened in the life of Judah from right around the time that Joseph was sold into slavery at Egypt by his brothers, and when Joseph reveals himself to his brothers and invites his whole family to come and live in security in Egypt. So during that 20-plus year period, Judah raises a family with a Canaanite wife. And unfortunately, when he and his wife marry their eldest son to a local girl named Tamar, apparently son number one is so sinful, such a bad guy, that God kills him, executes him, before he can have an heir. Now, according to the traditions of that time period, if you don't get an heir from that first marriage because of the death of the son, then you marry that same woman to the next eligible son. And the first boy that they have together will be counted as the son of the late son. This is all about property rights and line of inheritance. Who's going to be the double portion heir of this family line? Well, that short circuits as well, because the second brother doesn't want to really do this. He goes through the motions, but he cheats the woman from being able to get pregnant. So God executes him as well. And so Judah, thinking that Tamar, the woman, is an unlucky wife, basically tells her, you need to just go back home and I'll let you know when my other son and you can get married. But apparently had no intention of letting that happen. For some time goes by and no betrothal is forthcoming. So Tamar takes it into her own hands to get pregnant. And an opportunity presents itself when the Canaanite wife of Judah dies. And when he next goes to shear his sheep, Tamar goes to a place along the road that she knows he's going to pass by, pretends to be a prostitute, gets him to engage her in a transaction for sexual activity, and in the process takes some of his personal identification properties as the collateral for the payment of the act. She gets pregnant. He doesn't get a chance to pay for the activity because she disappears. But 3 months later, he is called to make a patriarchal decision. What do you do with a daughter-in-law who has become pregnant outside of marriage when she's supposed to have been saving herself for another son? And his answer was, let's burn her. Let's tie her to a stake and burn her up. Now, for him, I'm sure he was thinking this is a good way to get rid of unluckiness. But she then presents the identification pieces. And he realizes, she is a more righteous person than I am. Because here I am, trying to burn her at the stake when in fact I'm the one impregnated her. I'm the one that she, quote, cheated, end quote, with. She ends up with the baby that she was due, because that's the thing about all of this. The levirate marriage, the in-law marriage, was was a procedure to make sure that the woman is given a child so that that child can be part of the next generation in that family. Well, we take up the story now in the birth of the children, because suddenly we find out that Judah and Tamar have thrown twins in this pregnancy. Verse 27 of Genesis 38 says, "When the time of her labor came, there were twins in her womb. And when she was in labor, one put out a hand." So here comes the baby's hand. It's not the head cresting, it's a hand. And the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, "This one came out first." Now they have been able to feel her womb through her abdomen and have discovered, hey, there's two heads in there. And so they know that there are two babies inside. And so this midwife apparently has an idea. Perhaps it's something she's practiced before for twins, and that is, let's make sure we can identify the one who comes out first, because that's the heir. You remember the whole Jacob and Esau thing. Esau came out first, he's the heir, and Jacob was holding hot on his heel on the way out. So she, seeing the hand, went, "Whoop, that's where I got this scarlet thread for." So she ties it around really fast, and all of a sudden, verse 29, "But as he drew back his hand, behold, his brother came out." So the hand gets pulled back in, and moments later, a head crests, pushes out, come the shoulders, the arms, and then the rest just pops right out, and lo and behold, there's no scarlet thread on this one's arm. And so she, meaning the midwife, said, "Oh, what a breach you have made for yourself." So basically, wow, you just pushed yourself right out in front of your brother, didn't you? And therefore, he ends up with the name Perez. Now, Perez is Hebrew for breach, push forth, push into the middle. So that's how he gets his name. Now, afterward, verse 30 says, his brother came out with the scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was Zerah. Now, I have a technical question here that I would love to get answered, but I don't think I've ever seen this in any old ancient sources. I'll have to look a little bit better. And that is, which one was first born? Does Perez get the technicality because his arm was out first, or did your whole body have to come out? Now, I suspect that's the case, but there could be argumentation both ways. Now, Perez ends up being, let's see here. I think Perez is the one that's in the genealogy of Jesus, if I remember correctly. And so this is the genealogy of the royal family that we're seeing here, because Judah is the heir now of Israel, because his older three brothers have all disgraced themselves. Reuben disgraced himself by sleeping with his father's concubine, and Simeon and Levi disgraced themselves by murdering an entire city of men in order to make up for the fact that their brother, their sister, wanted to get married to a Canaanite of Shechem. And apparently they'd been sexually active before getting married. So that is the story of Judah. And Perez and Zerah will be babies whenever the story of Joseph comes to a climax and he brings his brothers and their families into Egypt. And so I just want you to kind of picture them in the story at that time. Now, we have to roll the time back again, back to 1908 BC, when Joseph has been thrown first into a pit by his brothers. They thought they were just going to let him die in there. But then they had the opportunity to sell him for money, you know, for silver, in order to have him taken away and sold into captivity far, far away in Egypt. So that story resumes in chapter 39. Now Joseph had been brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, and then our English Standard Version has here the captain of the guard, but it's actually head butcher in the literal Hebrew. And so I believe this guy is the head of food services for Pharaoh. So he's an Egyptian, and he had bought him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there. So the Ishmaelites, who are relatives of the Israelis, Ishmael was their uncle. And so it's some of their cousins, apparently, have turned to become traders, T-R-A-D-E-R-S, people who sell things, including slaves. So Joseph is actually sold in Egypt by his cousins. And he becomes the slave of the head of food services to the Pharaoh of Egypt. Now, this Pharaoh, whose name I don't think we can be sure of, he has a headquarters, a capital city, if you will, somewhere in the wrist region of the delta. Now, what I mean by that is, if you think of the delta of the Nile River as a palm, then the place where the Nile River feeds into the delta and splits it up into about seven streams, that place where the Nile River is still one singular river, I think of that as the wrist. And so somewhere in that vicinity has been a lot of the capital cities of pharaohs of ancient Egypt. Now, we call this Lower Egypt because it is closer to the ocean. It's closer to the Mediterranean Sea. It's lower in altitude. And so this is a very populous area because of the delta. And so the pharaoh is actually kind of like the head of a whole bunch of administrative heads in this whole region here. And so he has a reason to have a big house, and he needs a lot of food services to provide for the people coming to meet with the pharaoh on regular occasions. Sometimes business meetings would include dinner. Other times banquets would be celebratory of things achieved. So food services in the palace of Pharaoh is a big deal. And Joseph is now a slave under the guy that is in charge of all of that food services. Now, verse number 2. It says that he who is was with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his Egyptian master. His master saw that he who is was with him, and that he who is caused all that he did to succeed in his hands. So Joseph works in the private residence area. Now, he might be borrowed every once in a while to work in food services over at the palace, but his chief area of responsibility is at Potiphar's personal residence nearby. And we know that Abraham was promised by God, "I will bless those who bless you." That promise then fell to every one of the descendants, particularly following the line of the heir, but it's clearly evident in secondary lines as well. That the blessing of God just radiates outward from the people in this family tree. And so Joseph, who starts at this job when he's 17, he tries to do his best. And God blesses that best. And because God blesses his best, the overflow gets onto things around him. And so Potiphar notices very quickly that things have been going extra smoothly and even super beneficial since the arrival of this Hebrew slave. Verse number 4. So Joseph found favor in his sight and attended him. So Joseph kind of gets promoted and then promoted some more and then promoted some more. And every time he goes up the chain, that overflow of blessing gets broader and broader. And Potiphar is noticing this. And so eventually, and we don't know exactly when this happened, somewhere probably in his 20s, he made him overseer of his house and put him in charge of all that he had. So he puts him as the top guy at the personal residence, the one who gives orders to everybody else in the household. From the time that he made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, he who is blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. The blessing of he who is was all that he had in house and field. So it's not just what's going on in the residence. Joseph is also in charge of the things that are going on outside the residence, like making sure that the agriculture that is supporting this household is taken care of. That's being super blessed. The animals that are used for the support of this household, those are being blessed. So everything is being super blessed. And so Joseph is well known to Potiphar as a man that is very valuable as an employee. So verse 6, he left all that he had in Joseph's charge, and because of him, he had no concern about anything but the food he ate. So when Potiphar got up in the morning, Joseph had everything ready to go for him for the day. So Potiphar could, as soon as he's done having his breakfast, you know, feeding his face, that's about all he has to worry about. He takes off to the palace to take care of business there for the Pharaoh, you know, to do the food services stuff. And then when he comes home, probably late, you know, after a long day at the palace, he comes home and Joseph's got everything in hand. And all that Potiphar has to worry about is, you know, feeding his face again, getting a meal in before maybe he relaxes and then goes off to bed. Now, how long does that go on? Again, we don't know for sure. We do know that Joseph will stand before Pharaoh 2 years after having met a couple of people from food services as well while he's in prison. So 28 is the upper age of when he is going to be in prison and in trouble for the story that we're about to read. But how long did he spend in that prison? Again, we don't know. Maybe a few years. But I would put his age somewhere in the story in his mid-20s. And we are told at the end of verse 6, Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. Now that's a masculine formed phrase similar to what was said about his mother, Rachel. So he is a knockout from the male side of the gender story. And so he is probably muscular and very proportional in how he looks. He will definitely catch a woman's eye, and he does. Verse 7, after a time, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph. So Mrs. Potiphar takes note of this young man that first shows up and is like a low-ranking serving slave, and then he's pretty soon an intermediary, then a more senior slave, and then pretty soon he's working up the ranks until finally he's in charge of everything, and he is good at what he does. So he is smart, he is handsome, he is personable, and she wants him. And so she said to him, lie with me. So it's kind of that whole cougar thing going on here that everybody tries to make jokes about. But it's serious. She wants his body. And he refused. And he said to his master's wife, behold, because of me, my master has no concern about anything in the house. He's put me in charge of everything that he has is in my charge. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me, except, of course, yourself, because you're his wife. So Joseph tries to explain to her, you know, snap her out of this. I have come to this position because of your husband trusting me. He has given me control of everything around here. I'm his right-hand guy. Nothing happens around here unless I say it. The only thing that is off limits, obviously, in this household would be you, because you're married to my boss, the man who trusts me. And so then he finishes with this. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? So he falls back on the morality of the whole situation. You're married to this man. I can't sleep with you. It would be wrong. It would be a sin. It would be a sin against him. It would also be a sin against the God who created us all, male and female, and expected us to be committed to our spouse. So it's a bit of a rebuke of her, by the way. But she doesn't give up so easily. Verse 10, as she spoke to Joseph day after day, he would not listen to her to lie beside her or to be with her. So this just goes on and on for days and weeks, perhaps months, till she decides she's got to take more aggressive action. And I think it's possible, as some commentators say, that maybe she believed that Joseph's problem was fear of getting caught. So one day, when he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was there in the house. So why? Why is this house empty of workers? Only Joseph would be the one telling them not to come in, unless, of course, Mrs. Potiphar did. So apparently she has emptied the house of any possible witnesses. And then verse 12, she caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. Now this is where it helps to understand the garment culture of this place and this period. And we know this from seeing paintings and carvings of Egyptians. It was common practice for men to pretty much just wear this little kilt, and for women to wear something similar, but something that would also be off the shoulders. Although some of the pictures show it being kind of gauzy, the portion that was on the torso. And so Joseph would basically just be wearing a kilt over a loincloth. He'd be barefoot as well, because that seems to be what all the pictures portray for people. So she basically grabs his kilt, but he left his garment in her hand and fled and got out of the house. So he fled unrighteousness, just like the New Testament talks about. He ran away as fast as the little bare feet could take him. But she kept his kilt, his little white garment. And as soon as she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled out of the house, she called to the men of her household and said to them. So she decides to take control of the narrative. I think she was probably a little bit worried that that Joseph would go and report this now to Potiphar, and there would be trouble. And so she decides to seize the narrative, and so she grabs some of the people back into the house, and she said, "See, he," meaning Potiphar, "has brought among us a Hebrew to laugh at us, to make sport of us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And as soon as he heard that I'd lifted up my voice and cried out, he left his garment beside me and fled and got out of the house." So she accuses him of rape, attempted rape. And she first makes this attempted testimony to the household servants, but she will soon be telling this same story to her husband. Now, as we're wrapping up, I want you to understand, I think a lot of these servants would know that this was a lie right off the bat. After all, they've watched some of this happening. But that won't matter once the charges come before Potiphar.